Gun down.
In there. Okay, so what do you want?
Treadstone.
You better take a look around. There's not much left.
Are you Treadstone?
Am I Treadstone? Me? What the hell are you talking about? He's lost it. You better start filling in the blanks here, because I thought we were on the same side.
Whose side is that?
Boy, you don't know what you're doing, do you, Jason?
You don't have a goddamn clue.
Who am I? You're a U.S. government property. You're a malfunctioning $30 million weapon. You're a total goddamn catastrophe. And by God, if it kills me, you gotta tell me how this happened.
Why are you trying to kill me?
What happened in Marseille?
Why are you trying? You sent me to kill Wambosi.
Kill Wambosi? Yeah, we can do that anytime we want. I can send Nikki to do that, for Christ's sake. Mr. Wambosi was supposed to be dead 3 weeks ago. He was supposed to have died in a way where the only possible explanation was that he'd been murdered by a member of his own entourage. I don't send you to kill. I send you to be invisible. I send you because you don't exist. Now, I want to know what happened in Marseille.
I don't remember what happened in Marseille.
Bullshit! This is unacceptable, soldier. You hear me? You failed.
Unacceptable!
You failed! You failed, and you're gonna tell me why.
I can't tell you. I can't. I don't remember.
You brought John McCain to life.
Thing.
You put together a meeting with Wambosi. You found the security company.
I don't.
You broke into the office. For Christ's sake, you're the one who picked the yacht as a goddamn strike point. You picked the boat. You picked the day. You tracked the crew. You used the fuel. You told us where. You told us when. You hit out on that boat 5 days. You were in, Jason. You were in. It was over.
The Matahari of Mind Control. Candy Jones was a sex symbol during World War II. Born Jessica Wilcox, with her catchy stage name and shapely legs, she rose as a standing second only to Betty Grable as America's most popular pinup girl. She was a favorite of the troops at the front, and she felt it a duty to entertain them in the battlefields. After advertised beauty failed, she could no longer serve to raise the morale of the troops with her appearance, so she served her country in another way. She served under MKUltra as a hypnoprogram CIA courier for 12 years. While in a USO tour in the Pacific in 1945, Candy contracted a case of undulant fever and shortly thereafter malaria. On top of that, she caught the contagious fungus known as jungle rot. And within a week, her hair began to fall out, and her complexion had turned a sickly yellow. The combination of these diseases sent her to a military hospital in Manila, where she met a young medical officer who identifies himself as a pseudonym Gilbert Jensen. He would later offer her the opportunity to become a CIA courier. In 1959, Candy started a modeling school in New York. She rented office space in a modern skyscraper across the hall from an office occupied by the one-time heavyweight boxing champion, Gene Tunney. One night, Candy noticed a supposed cleaning lady fumbling for her keys to open Tunney's door. The next day, Tunney reported that his office had been burglarized, but that nothing important had been stolen. Later in the week, Candy observed a young couple approaching Tunney's door. She watched as the young man took out a set of keys and went through the same trial-and-error process that the cleaning lady had performed a few nights earlier. Candy went into the hallway and asked the young man what he was doing. He told her that he was supposed to meet Tunney there. Candy informed him that Tunney had left hours before and was not expected back until that evening. The couple left. The next day, Candy told Tunney about the incident. He wasn't alarmed, nor did he even seem to be interested that a second burglary of his office had been attempted. One day later, in the lobby of the building, Candy ran into a retired Army general she'd known in the South Pacific. The general had not known her well in the past, but now he was more than courteous. He mentioned that he was on his way to have lunch with Tunney, so Candy invited him to her office first and showed him around. Then she brought him across the hall to Tunney. Tunney seemed quite surprised that Candy had known the general, and after a brief conversation, the two men went to lunch and Candy continued with her business. A few days later, Candy was visited by a man who introduced himself as an FBI agent. He asked her about the burglary of Tunney's office, and Candy told him what she had told both Tunney and the superintendent of the building. The FBI man then unexpectedly went over to the window ledge and picked up a microphone Candy obtained from the Allen Fund of Candid Camera fame. The agent wanted to know what use Candy had for the microphone. She explained that she used it to tape her models' voices to help them develop their speech. The agent said that he'd been looking for such a microphone to use in a surveillance job on 57th Street. He asked Candy if she would mind if he borrowed it. Flattered that she'd been asked to help the FBI, Candy offered it for a long time, as long as it was needed. The FBI man thanked her and left with the microphone. When he returned a month later, he was accompanied by another agent. After making casual conversation for a few minutes, the FBI man asked Candy if she would be allowed to have some of their mail delivered to her office. There would be letters addressed to fictitious names in care of her modeling school. Some of the letters, they said, might be mailed from Europe and addressed to her. Or, to be specified, fictitious names. If that happened, she was supposed to call a number and report the arrival of the mail. Candy, once again flattered, said be happy to help. 2 weeks after Candy took the job with the FBI, Gene Tunney moved out of his office. The retired Army general, however, kept in touch with her all during that year. He invited her to several parties and even sent her a Christmas card. In the summer of 1960, Candy received a letter at her apartment from the first FBI man, and the next day, the retired general called her at the office. Somehow, he knew she was going to be taking a trip at an all-male Tuesday night supper club in Denver, and afterwards going to San Francisco to attend a fashion show. The general wondered if she would mind carrying a letter from a government agency since she was going to California anyway. He told her that the letter was to be delivered to a man who would call himself at her hotel and identify himself. Again, flattered to be called upon to serve her country, Candy agreed to act as a courier. The important letter was hand-delivered to Candy's office a few days after the general's phone call. There were two envelopes. A large one contained her instructions and a smaller one contained the actual letter. Candy carried the letter with the Herald to Denver, then on to San Francisco, where she first arranged for her contact. Within a few days, she received a call from her hotel from a man who identified himself as Jill Jensen. It was the same man who had been Candy's doctor in the Philippines. Jensen invited her to dinner that evening at the Mark Hopkins Hotel. During dinner, Candy brought up to the subject of the letter, but Jensen avoided the subject, saying they could not talk about it at his office until the next day. Candy protested that she had to go back to New York that next day, but Jensen would take her no for an answer. He told her it would be worth her while to stay on for a few days. "There's something interesting here for you work with," to do with the Central Intelligence Agency, Candy, without interfering with your business. He told her the work could be quite lucrative, and since at the time she needed money, she decided to stay and find out what the CIA was offering. The next day, a car picked Candy up at her hotel and drove her across the Bay Bridge to the Oakland offices of Dr. Jensen. That was the beginning of what Candy's biographer, Donald Bain, described as 12 years of adventure, which would eventually take her to the Far East as a covert operative of the CIA. Bain tells Candy's story in his book, The Control of Candy Jones. She would be harassed, badgered, and even tortured. Her role was small, a carrier of messages, and the fact that she chose initially to perform such duties for pay renders the misfortunes that befell her occupational hazards. What Candy had in her bargain for, however, was becoming a human guinea pig in a secret CIA scientific project in which mind control was the goal. She was an unwilling and unknowing laboratory subject for 12 years, and only her chance marriage saved her from the final stage of her adventure. Her own suicide is choreographed by Dr. Gilbert Jensen. In 1973, Candy Jones married an old friend, Long John Nebel, the host of a New York all-night radio talk show. Candy had met John in 1941 at the height of her career when John was working as a freelance photographer assigned by a magazine to photograph Candy. After losing contact with her for more than a decade, they accidentally renewed their acquaintance and were married 28 days later. On their wedding night, John noticed her bride was suddenly acting out of character. She had left the bed and gone into the bathroom to look in the mirror. When she returned, John said, "I saw somebody who was only resembled the woman I'd married." He stressed the word resembled because although the body which walked out of the bathroom belonged to Candy, the being inside did not. Her voice was cold and distant, and her expressions were cruel. Soon the strange, bitter mood passed, and the warm, loving Candy returned. The next evening, Candy's strange mood returned. John naturally became curious about his wife's psychological history, and he began asking questions about her past. Candy told him about her 1959 contact with the FBI. She also told him that from time to time she would have to take little trips for the government. On June 3, 1973, John and Candy came home early in the morning after doing one of his all-night talk shows. Candy tried to sleep but found she could not. She tossed and turned, and when she complained to John of her sleeplessness, she was near in tears. John told Candy that he'd read that hypnosis could relax insomniacs, and although he never had tried to put anyone into a trance state, he'd read a lot about it, and he suggested perhaps they ought to try it. Candy laughed and said, "I can't be hypnotized, John." But a short while after John began to hypnotize her, Candy was deeply asleep. Although John had no way of knowing it then, Candy was already a highly suggestible subject, and she had been hypnotized on many previous occasions by the CIA. Because of this, whatever John sought to induce trance in Candy, she rapidly became relaxed and was able to get a full night's natural sleep. One night, while under John's hypnosis, Candy suddenly and spontaneously began to relive her childhood. During this age regression, she revealed many terrible incidents in what had been an obviously lonely and troubled past. In dreamlike monologues, she related how her father had abused her. Once, when she was 11, he'd crushed her fingers one by one in a nutcracker because she wouldn't cry when he was about to leave. Candy's portrayal of her mother depicted a person only a little less cruel than her father. A calculating woman, she often locked Candy inside a closet as a form of punishment. In several hypnotic monologues, Candy revealed how she had been developed an alter personality named Arlene to fend her from the blows of her formative years. Later, John was able to discover the despicable personality which he had observed taking over his wife's consciousness on their wedding night was the same alter she developed in her childhood. John Nebel began audio taping his wife's hypnotic monologues. Bain failed to say in his book whether or not Candy's alter was a manifestation of what wanted to be programmed, but that she didn't know what was to end up. John asked Arlene, who had developed her, and she replied, "Mother Jensen, he hatched me like a mother hen." Jensen had told her to come through Candy's stomach. She said he'd say, "AG, AG," and Candy would experience a severe stomach pain before Arlene took over her personality. When she refused to come when she was called, Jensen would give Candy an injection, and one day he miscalculated and gave her 3 injections, which put Candy to sleep for 14 hours. Jensen had quite a scare because he had a difficult time reviving her. Under John's hypnosis, Candy revealed that she had been given a number of drugs by Jensen, possibly Amazon, Reserpin, and Sulfazine, as well as truth drugs sodium amethyl and sodium pentothal. She was programmed not to allow any doctor except Jensen to treat her, and never to allow anyone to give her Thorazine, the powerful tranquilizer. The details of Candy's role as a mind-controlled CIA courier were pieced together from hundreds of hours of tapes of her hypnotic monologues. She worked for the DIA under a professional name, Candy Jones, under the name Arlene Grant, and under her given name, Jessica Wilcox. She was first ordered to lease a post office box at Grand Central Station in the name of Jessica Wilcox in August of 1961. She maintained this box until 1968 or 1969 and paid for it herself. Mail seldom arrived at the box, but when it did, Candy would take it to her office and hold it and give it to an unidentified man who always made the pickup, or sometimes a phone call would order Candy to deliver certain letters to various locations around the city. Slowly it began to dawn on Candy that some of the people she was delivering mail to might be just the kind of people who could kill her for reasons of their own. To protect herself, she wrote a letter to her attorney and put 2 copies in a safe deposit box at different banks. The letter stated that for reasons she couldn't disclose, she often used the names Arlene Grant, Jessica Wilcox, and Candy Jones. She wanted to put on a record the fact that these different names all referred to her. In the event of her death, she wrote, whether it was due to accident or sudden illness, whether it happened in the United States or outside the country, there should be a thorough investigation. She wrote that although she was not at liberty to divulge her silent activities, she was not performing illegal, immoral, or unpatriotic acts. Candy held the assumption to the end of her days, even after hearing her own voice under hypnosis tell tales of physical torture, of illegal entries and exits from the country, and the most shocking kind of abuse at the hands of CIA. Candy probably still would do almost anything out of this hypnotic, cultivated sense of patriotism. Eventually, John tried to get his wife to see a psychiatrist, but she refused, saying that if she did not, she would go get very sick at night and may even have a convulsion. Evidently, Jensen had told her this. Even talking about possible therapy gave Candy severe stomach cramps. Candy had been programmed so that she would not only be protected from foreign intelligence operations, but from everyone, the CIA included. Jensen planned to use her for some evil design of his own. Candy Jones was, in fact, not one, but 2 zombies, Candy and Arlene, sibling rivals trapped inside the same skin. They would talk to each other, but never about each other to anyone but Jensen. They traveled together on CIA assignments, Candy Jones being the person who acted within the United States, and Arlene Grant the person who took over once the airplane left the country. Usually, when Candy arrived in San Francisco from New York, she would immediately go to Jensen's office. There, she would change clothes, don a black wig, and pick up her fake passport in the name of Arlene Grant. Jensen would call forth the Arlene possibility and send her off to Southeast Asia to deliver her messages. In his book, Donald Bain writes that Arlene would carry in an envelope, but he wonders, wisely, if in fact there was her an envelope. This time to get a girl to go to a gallery. She remembers that the girl took the envelope from her. She spit in her face, and under hypnosis, Candy could not recall any reason why the girl had done so. After delivering the message, Arlene was picked up by the same man and driven to his home. Again, she was tortured with electrodes and questioned about the content of the message that she delivered. When she would not or could not answer, her torturers put her hand in a box which contained a scorpion. This apparently was supposed to be a scare tactic for when the scorpion bit her. The torturers immediately stopped the shocks and gave her antibiotics and administered other medical treatment. Candy told her husband that on other occasions her thumbnails had been cut to the quick in an attempt to make her talk. She remembered that this had taken place on January 24, 1968. On still another occasion, something had been put in her ears to cause pain. But throughout all this torture Jensen's program held, she said nothing. In another hypnosis session, Arlene told about getting dizzy in a Taiwan hotel after having one drink. She began to sweat profusely and went to a bathroom which had already a little dressing room in it and a bed. An attendant accompanied her and took her clothing and hung them up since she had become drenched with perspiration. She was given a dressing gown and allowed to lie down. Eventually, a doctor came to see her. He gave her an injection and she drifted off to sleep. After the doctor left the room, the female attendant came over and began to pinch her on different parts of her body, asking her where the papers were. Where the attendant began to pinch Arlene's nipples, she fainted from the pain. The woman persisted, repeatedly pulling her to a sitting position and severely pinching her nipples. When the woman finally left the room, Candy remembers, she tried to crawl under the bed to hide. The doctor came back and gave her another injection. And the next day, she woke and dressed. She was courteously escorted to the airport by her torturers as if nothing happened. When she got back to Jensen's office, she reported the incident to him. He seemed most concerned about it, but when he asked to see her bruises, she refused to show him her black and blue nipples. On a number of occasions, Candy was sent to the Central Intelligence Agency's training ground called the Farm. Known to the outside world as Camp Peary, it appeared to be an ordinary military installation. There, Candy learned how to search a room, including various guerrilla warfare tactics, including how to commit undetectable arson. She was taught how to use a poison lipstick to take her own life, and how to use the same lipstick to kill someone else by sticking a pin inside it, then jabbing the intended victim. She learned how to use acid as a defensive and offensive weapon. She learned how to fire various weapons, how to climb ropes, and how to write coded messages on her fingernails and then cover them with polish. The training at the Farm was known as 3D, Detection, Destroy, and Demolish. At one point, Candy told her husband of an especially outrageous incident which took place at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. She had been taken to an amphitheater where more than two dozen CIA men were gathered to witness a performable Dr. Jensen's staple of zombies. There were eight subjects scheduled for a performance, and Candy was the first. In a deep hypnotic trance, she was made to lie naked on a table. The table was wheeled before the CIA audience, and Candy was introduced to the group as Laura Quidnick. She wore her Arlene wig during the entire performance. Dr. Jensen demonstrated his complete control over the prone, disrobed figure of Candy Jones. He lit a candle and told his nude subject that she would not feel a thing. Then he shoved the burning candle deep into her vagina. Several of the witnesses tried to break through Jensen's control, but they all failed. "Candy is perfect," Arlene told John. Jensen proved in Virginia how impossible it was to break his control. Piecing together such a fragmented incident of Candy's CIA secret past, John Nebel discovered that his wife had been programmed to commit suicide once she was no longer useful to the CIA. The self-destruct program was to be activated in Nassau. She was to check into the Paradise Beach Hotel on December 31, 1972. She'd stayed at the hotel many times before on normal business trips, so there was nothing unusual about that. But on this occasion, Arlene was primed to spontaneously take over Candy's body upon receiving a phone call from Jensen. She was programmed to walk Candy's body to a steep cliff overlooking the sea and there to make a high cliff dive. This was to be the last dive of Candy Jones' life. for that location, her body would be certainly have crashed into the rocks on the beach below. It was extremely fortunate that Candy married John DeBell on that very day she was supposed to check into the hotel. The marriage, by putting off the NASA trip, had short-circuited Jensen's program of suicide, which had been scheduled for the same month. But today, despite John's help in countering much of Jensen's programming, Candy is still not completely free of his control over her mind. Still, whenever she looks into a mirror, she feels Arlene struggling to take over her consciousness. Although Candy told Jensen that she was through working for the agency in the middle of 1972, more than 6 months after she and John were married, a strange phone call was recorded on the answering machine. The message was, "Japan Airlines calling on 3rd of July at 4:10 p.m. Please have Miss Grant call 759-9100. She's holding new reservations on Japan Airlines Flight 5 for the 6th of July, Kennedy, Tokyo, with an open to Taipei. This is per Cynthia that we are calling. Thank you." A check with Japan Airlines disclosed that the number 759-9100 was indeed the reservation number for the airline. There was, however, no record in the airline's computer of the reservation or record of who made it. Neither was there a reservation clerk named Cynthia or anyone else at the airline by that name. The "per Cynthia" phrase was to have been a code that was supposed to trigger Candy's autonomic program and may have been a thin disguise for the agency represented by Cynthia's first and last two letters. Candy's controlled mind and John DeBell's sense of patriotism prevented the whole truth of the story from emerging. For some reason, John DeBell, Candy Jones, and Donald Bain concealed the real names of Candy's programmers. In Bain's book, the name Gilbert Jensen is said to be a pseudonym. Another doctor who was supposedly conditioned to hate and distrust people is given the name Dr. Marshall Berger in the book, though at one point there's a footnote stating that DeBell wondered if Berger wasn't the cover name for the California hypnotist Dr. William Jennings Bryan. In a document supposed to have come from a CIA briefing, it was noted that Bryan had been one of the programmers of Sirhan Sirhan. Bryan, as noted in an earlier chapter, was the hypnotist and physician who offered the long-distance instant diagnosis that Gary Powers had been powerized by the Soviets. He was formerly a hypnotist for the Air Force and been liked to the CIA. He was also the technique consultant for the film The Manchurian Candidate. According to April 22, 1969, Los Angeles Times, the California State Board of Medical Examiners found him guilty of, quote, "unprofessional conduct and four cases involving sexual molesting of a female patient," end quote. For this offense, Bryan was only placed on 5 years probation. The lightness of the penalty might well have been accompanied through his connections with CIA. Alan Schlefflin, an attorney for 5 years, had been researching the subject of mind control for his book, The Mind Manipulators, and says he has evidence which suggests that the Nobels and Donald Bain may be concealing the fact that the doctor who programmed Candy is the same doctor who programmed Lee Harvey Oswald, James Earl Ray, and Sirhan Sirhan. In early 1976, Candy Jones and I both spoke on the KSAN radio special on mind control. I was interviewed via telephone and Candy was interviewed in the studio. We did not meet face to face, but KSAN provided all the participants with duplicate tapes of the program. On the KSAN program, Candy Jones and Donald Bade both insisted, despite my own evidence and arguments, the testimony of Jessica Milford and the evidence provided by two other investigative reporters that Candy had been only a human penny pig used for experimental purposes. The records of CIA Mind Control Project clearly show, however, that during the 1960s, the Cryptocracy's mind control had gone far beyond the experimental stage. On that radio show, Candy herself revealed that Sir William Stevenson, a man called Intrepid, believed that she was no guinea pig. She reported that Stevenson wrote her that as far back as the early days of World War II, he used zombie agents like her in the service of British intelligence. Shortly after the program, was aired, I called Nivelle's office to try and make contact with Candy or John. They had ignored my previous letters and my calls and were taken by their producer, who tried to help me out but finally had to report that Nivelle's were not interested in being interviewed. I subsequently learned that neither would they grant an interview to John Marks of the Center for the National Security Studies. They turned him down as flatly as they turned me down. My attempt to clarify the question of whether or not Dr. William Jennings Bryan had anything to do with programming Candy Jones was also frustrated by his avoidance of me. I persisted in trying to get an interview with him until March of 1977, when Dr. Bryan died prematurely at the age of 50, allegedly of a heart attack. He was a rather flamboyant man who toured the country holding, quote, conferences where he would lecture on the use of hypnosis in police interrogation. He died at one such conference in Las Vegas, Nevada, only months after his name was raised in connection with Candy Jones. Both John Long and Candy are now molding in their own graves. Among their legacy are the questions which beg for their answers. What are the real names of the men who programmed Candy? Why weren't they included in the book? What are Candy's and John's personal political affiliations? Why were they not outraged by Candy's manipulation? Why are they attempting to protect the guilty and justify the rape of Candy's body and mind by the national security rationale? Why wouldn't they sit still and let me interview them in detail? In light of Candy's disclaimer and the Nivelle's refusal to clear up these questions, I can only ask the reader to decide whether or not Candy Jones was a courier in a fully operational sense, or only as an experimental guinea pig, as she tried to make us believe.